Wessex Press, an imprint of Gasogene Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers. The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock's Holmes, is a collection of essays written by online fans. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com.
Ever since the inception of the Baker Street Journal in 1946, it has been the gold standard for Sherlockian criticism, playing the game, articles on Holmes-related Victoriana, and the occasional cheeky essay. To boot, the folks running the show are great friends of the Babes. To learn more, you need only visit www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street Babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh. So when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1 be mine?
Welcome to podcast number 72 of the Baker Street Babes. Today we have Sora, we have Amy, we have Tiffany and Tamara, new babes, on their first podcast joining us today. So very excited about that. And today is going to be a reaction episode of A Study in Pink season 1, which we started doing because we have done reaction episodes from season 2 onwards, but not the first season. And so last time we did the pilot, and today we'll talk about A Study in Pink. Before we do that, though, we just want to mention that we have a new website. We redid it almost completely. The features are still the same, but they're ordered slightly differently. It's online now, so very super excited about that. Please go have a look at bakerstreetbabes.com. And what you can do is you can leave us voice messages. And we received a very, very lovely voice message by Evelyn.
Hi, I just want to say I'm a big fan of your podcast, and yours is one of the two alongside Welcome to Night Vale that has inspired me to start podcasting myself. My project is actually kind of Sherlockian in that it is a crossover between Ace Attorney and Sherlock, as there's a game that's been released in Japan that's unfortunately never going to be coming to the West, that alongside some friends who've roughly translated it, we've turned it into an audio drama, and with the help of some really, really amazing actors, we're making this into something that should be really cool and a very different adaptation of some of the stories. The first episode should be up between April or May, and so far it's going really well. Now, I just wanted to quickly ask you guys, if you could cosplay as any character from the canon or from any adaptation, who would it be and why? It's been really fun to listen to all of your back catalogue, and I'm looking forward to future episodes, so thank you for everything. And it's also really cool to know that there's other fans out there who like Sherlock, just like me. We are basically like a big extended family, and alongside cosplayers and online fandom, it's been really cool to actually communicate with that extended family. So thanks for everything, and hope to speak soon. Bye!
And so thank you very much, Evelyn, for your lovely, lovely comment. And to answer your question, so we can just sort of go through each of us, mention that, who would you want to cosplay if you had the chance of cosplaying any character from any adaptation of the Sherlock Holmes stories? So Sora, maybe you want to start.
Ooh, this is okay. If I could cosplay it and actually look really good doing it, it'd probably be a Moriarty from BBC, of course. I mean, if you know me, you know that's no surprise. But I definitely want to do his Victorian outfits, because I was talking with Jun from Sherlock Unraveled, and he was giving me all the details about it, and it's amazing. And if I could do it and actually rock it, I'd be all over that. Although getting these curls of mine to fold back into a nice slick, you know, do. If Benedict could do it, then I can do it.
Would you go with a wound in the head or not?
Of course. I love me a little bit of blood and gore. You know how awesome that would be? Like, I'd just be like, oh, hi. Like, reach behind and be like, hey. And then, like, gather some of the blood and then hold my hand up and be like, what's up? No, I always like a little bit of gore. It tickles my morbid fascination with things. Yeah, that'd be neat. Oh God, I can do the gun thing and get on my knees and be all like, "Hey," creepy to people, make them as horribly uncomfortable as possible. Because it's Moriarty in a nutshell. What about you guys?
All right, Amy.
Wow, that was a really exciting answer. Actually, I have already cosplayed kind of my ultimate cosplay. I 2 years ago at 221B Con, I was actually Sherlock Holmes, but I was Sherlock Holmes from a Sherlock Holmes and Jane Austen mashup. So, Holmes and Watson are Regency young women, and so I had a Regency gown from a period pattern, and my sister actually did traditional embroidery of a bee on my sleeves. I was very proud. So I was Sherlock Holmes that time, and that's probably the apex of my cosplay career, not gonna lie. Probably not any better than that because my sister did all the work. Shout out.
There's, I find cosplay is an ever-growing thing. You can only get better. There's no such thing as getting worse. Which means if you can't get bad, you can only get better. Therefore, you must do it again and again and again. I mean, come on, think about it. How awesome would it be all the Baker Street Babes cosplaying together?
One of these days we'll all be together. That's the first hurdle.
Oh, it's
True,
already in,
true.
it's in the plans. I'm making it my goal. At one point, I will make sure that all of us are together. I'm
Yes.
gonna make it happen.
We're getting closer. So what about you guys?
Yes. Tiffany and Tamar, whoever wants to go first.
Tamar, go first.
Thanks, Tiffany. I would. Well, this is harkening back now to my background as a former amateur stage manager and having a succession of roommates with endless fascinations with horror makeup. So I'd actually love to do Neville St. Clair, because I can actually do a pretty mean scar.
Nice.
And and I don't know how I would work around the glasses, but that's always a challenge. And he's a character where, they're not pince-nez, they're probably a little bit broader than a gentleman of his ilk would be sporting, but I feel like the wig, the scar, and glasses, like that's a challenge. I'd be up for that challenge.
Wow. That would be amazing. That would be
That's the
cool.
reaction I'm hoping for, is I'm stuck
Yes.
terror.
So I've done several cosplays already. My favorite that I'm still working on, because at some point I want to make it to what I actually want to make it to the point of, is my Femme Sherlock canon lock. I have one that I have, but I want to keep, like, it's not done yet. Like, it's never to a point. Plus, Invernesses are a pain to make. But I think out of ones that I've thought of that would be really cool is either I'd love to do something. Find a reason to like either do one of Holmes's disguises within a disguise. So sort of
Oh,
at
yeah.
the, one of those moments where I can pull off a mask and pull off the hair and the beard and everything and have it to that point. Or another one being, I love the idea of at some point just doing a Violet Hunter in her electric blue gown,
Oh,
red hair
that's.
and whatnot, that I always think is just it would be so beautiful, but I need like a reason to do it that would be really recognizable. I mean, like 221 Beacon or something would be a good place for that, but somewhere where, canonically the reference is going to be like caught.
Actually, mine's actually not very. I mean, it's a. I want to be the dinosaur from Asylum Homes.
my God,
Because,
Maria.
like, it works in so many different strata. Like, you could crash a Sherlock Holmes party and people would know what it is. And you could also go to, like, a Jurassic Park party and it would still work.
Doctor
So
Who.
that was basically my first reaction when I was thinking about that. So just be the dinosaur.
When you do your dinosaur costume thing, I'm going to follow behind you with the stereo playing the Jurassic Park theme. Just aggressively, like, waltzing behind you. And then we'll swap into like a Sherlock theme. Just keep going back and forth between the two. Mashup.
Great. That sounds great. Okay, Evelyn, now we answered your question very elaborately. well, I think it would be a lot of fun to just have this very random assortment of dressed up babes. So you can also leave voicemails or voice messages on our website, and we will do our best to answer them if you ask questions or if you have any comments. So please do that. Which also leads us to the fact that because of the new website and because of several, things that have to do with podcasting and sort of keeping up websites, etc., we're always looking for sponsors who can support us in our endeavors. So if you feel like we are something that you would like to be connected with, or you you want us to, you know, give you shout outs for whatever product you have to sell or whatever book you're publishing or whatever project you have going on, if you want to sponsor us, please get in touch with us. We'd be very happy to help you if you help us, so we can continue doing what we do on a regular basis as we're doing right now. So thank you very much to our current sponsors, but we're always happy if somebody else gets in touch too. So today, as we promised, we'll talk about A Study in Pink, the first proper episode, which was of season one, actually the one that was filmed last, because obviously Stephen Moffat is always the one who takes longest with his scripts. But it also means that in A Study in Pink, we get all of the lovely on-screen writing special effects, which were still developed throughout season one. So that is one of the special things, which I think did a great deal to impress everyone very much so when we watched it. But we'll sort of go through it chronologically, and maybe we can start or jump right in with John Watson and his nightmares.
Oh, even when the poor baby woke up crying and it made my heart hurt. Ugh. It was painful because, you know, he has a nightmare, and then I'm like, oh, I mean, being that my father is in the military, I am incredibly familiar with PTSD and seeing it firsthand. So for me watching it, it was a bit almost kind of personal to see it. And it kind of just breaks my heart to see this man wake up and just sobbing over a dream that he had. Well, more like a nightmare, a memory, if you will.
And it was very realistic because it's sort of, you know, documentary style, hand camera, just following, you know, the running, the movement. So I think that also drives the point home that before John wakes up, it just seems really super real.
Yeah, it communicates, I think, the chaos of what war was. And it almost like, and I think it's a great sort of reflection of the life that John was used to, is constantly being on the run, being shot at, all this stuff happening at him. And then now he's just sitting in this sad little bed, staring at the wall. I mean, he was basically, he needed somebody to come rolling in and, you know, jazz things up a bit.
This solidifies that we're getting John Watson's perspective, which is something that obviously, even though it's a modern series, is very traditional to the stories, but it's not something that's the case in a lot of adaptations on film and TV. And so I think in a weird way, even though it's obviously very, very modern, it also gave me a very traditional feel. Like, this is the John Watson that I'm expecting to see. Maybe the PTSD and everything brought to the surface rather than being more between the lines mm-hmm. stories. But it also says, you know, we're going to see Sherlock Holmes happening to us, as opposed to us going along and getting Sherlock Holmes's perspective. John Watson is this, you know, sort of down on his luck guy, and this thing named Sherlock Holmes happens to him.
You mean like the storm Sherlock? He was like a hurricane rolling into there. Because, I mean, I think they did a fantastic job with the way they presented that bed set. I mean, the details in it, the bed was like military precision made. John was just in plain clothing. He didn't look as awesome, and I'm presuming that clothes that he was wearing were probably not that expensive, because John Watson's wardrobe's expensive, frugal or not. Everything was just plain. It was dull. Even the coloring, the lighting, everything was just bland as could be. And then later on, and obviously in the Reichenbach fall, we had an excellent reflection. I mean, we went almost right back to that dour sadness. And then, yeah, then Sherlock happened, and the world lit up with curls and cheekbones and collars that make him look cool.
It also was a great way to, I mean, comparative to other series where, you know, you either have the narration or you have various ways of introducing John Watson. This was far more dragging you straight into the story, just like kind of how the story opens in canon, which is one of the things that really caught it for me as a person watching it. Like, I remember one of the first, I had been told about the series, but going into it and seeing this nightmare scene and having the battle there and making that connection and starting with it outside of the world of Sherlock Holmes also was one of the things that impressed me the most, because it really reflected with me on how this is likely to be true to canon, because that was the question. Is it really going to have all of those connections? And immediately, without even getting to the Afghanistan or Iraq bit, this was a, oh, by the way, did you realize, like, we're at the same war that we were in 150 years ago? And really, you're in the same situation. You have the same circumstances all set up for the same kind of play, but that's not so different from where we were in Victoriana in, you know, 1880, 1893, you know, when they first met.
And we do get the computer, and we do get John Watson as a writer in one way or another. I mean, he doesn't write, right, which is indicative of, you know, the issues he's having. But even before we get to know the therapist and that it's her idea for him to write, we know, you know, he's still writing somehow in this version of things. So that made me very happy as well. And one thing which I noticed for the first time this time, the use of the apple that he puts on the table can only be a reference to the IOU of Moriarty later on. I mean, that is the only... I mean, nothing happens to the apple except for the fact that he puts it on the table and it just sits there.
There's a theory about that, indicating that it was another sign of the severity of John's PTSD, because, and I know this is also true as well, is that some PTSD victims have an extreme lack of appetite and they seem to be pretty lightweight or whatnot. But like you, I also thought maybe it was a reference to the IOU, to the apple, to Moriarty strolling in there.
To branch off of the food reference too, I think I've read that meta because it was something that struck me when I was watching it as well, had also gone through my head watching it a couple times initially, was the idea that you don't really see Watson eat until Holmes kind of nudges him into it way into the series around the same time that he's losing his limp. Mm. But if you look, there's a lot of references to, like, he either turns down tea or he's not, you know, he's got the coffee and he's holding it, but he's not really drinking it. There's the apple. And going even back to Jack Cannon, where it kind of mentions that he had weight loss and everything due to his illness, going instead with the PTSD thing, that was something that just struck me, because you kind of see that he's just listless and nothing gathers his like attention. Now, whether later on they decided to use the apple for the IOU, I could see that being a situation or the case, but that was just, that was how it had struck me when I first watched it.
Which makes total sense, because, I mean, obviously when they were writing Pink, they had no idea they were going to do any further episodes. But that was sort of the initial idea that I had, is that it's like, if you want anything to represent a sad, terrified, lonely John Watson, you just use that apple and have Moriarty carve words into it.
Well, he wasn't lying, he was able to burn the heart out of you, or I guess in this case, carving letters out of, I don't know. The apple is interesting, because maybe it could mean something else. There's so much meta out there that is actually interesting that, I mean, just going over the apple, I've heard they're saying already they're starting to interlay the whole fairy tale aspect, because you know how Moriarty was saying every villain, or every fairy tale needs a good old-fashioned villain. So they're saying they're already planting that early hint in there. I saw the one about the PTSD. I mean, there's loads of theories out there.
Wow. And that just sparked something for me, is that, of course, one of the primordial associations with the apple is temptation, or with a fruit. And even before we're interposing Moriarty, because we know exactly the shadow he's going to cast, but it's really Sherlock who's the danger, who's the temptation, that so much of studying Pink is about, to me, was about Watson's, sort of everyone else around him assuming things about his being drawn to Sherlock, and then Watson's sort of own belated recognition, internalization, and then just helpless laughter about it, really. So that it kind of traces the assumptions about a live-in, a boyfriend, a date, that's a matter to that can be unpacked separately, to be sure, but even just his proximity. It's assumed by Mycroft, it's assumed by Lestrade, and Watson, until about three-quarters of the way through, seems sort of like, you know, he's along for the ride, he's being borne about, but he hasn't necessarily chosen it. Instead that at the end, he does choose the apple. He does move in.
Yeah, he decides to take a bite and move in with this crazy man with the... I don't know, I thought it was... I agree, it's a very good kind of connection there.
Yeah, I actually have one more, and I know we branched way off on this first thing, but I actually noticed this, because there's an extremely specific shot where you see the Royal Army Medical Corps mug, and you see the apple.
Yeah.
And because, obviously, we didn't have Moriarty, and we didn't have, I mean, the idea was there, obviously, but we didn't have the rest of the series, I almost see it like the apple might be the temptation of the danger that he is to himself, because obviously we have yet to sort of address the fact that he has a gun that he shouldn't have, and possible thoughts about where his life is going or not going, versus a mug there that symbolizes the adventures that he's had and his ongoing craving for more of those adventures. And so I would almost wonder whether it's possible that the apple symbolizes the temptation not to take up a life with Sherlock and not to regain the things that he's lost by saying yes to those adventures.
Mm.
You know, at this point in time, we can come up with so much meta on even just one small thing.
But I think that makes it kind of fun. Whether or not it's true, it's still the fact that it's getting us thinking about it. It's letting, we're examining this thing almost as much as you would examine text. I think it's a great way that we're introducing new Sherlockians in here. I mean, I know they're not analyzing the canon as much, but they are analyzing this film. It's getting them in that sort of mindset of look beyond what is just in front of your eyes, I think is important.
Yeah, and it's the way also the series is filmed. I mean, if you just look at the art direction, like add what details we get to
don't
see.
Get me started on
just
that
thing, makes... if you just think of the cases, right? So we have the suicides, and it's just, you know, the focus on the eyes. We even have, you know, the sunlight reflecting in the eyeball of this one guy, you know. It's just these moments, these close-ups of the eyes of the victims, you know, the sort of the tears that are merging into rain. I mean, it's just so, you know, the eye for detail that I think changed the game in way of how television.
Yeah, it makes
made.
It captivating.
Yeah, when we talk about the first meeting we have with the writing, I think everybody was just floored by that. Is the wrong during the press conference, right? So if you think of you know, we get to know Lestrade not as a very active person, right? We get to know Donovan much as a much more active person than Lestrade. But then we get the wrong, and before we know who Sherlock Holmes is, basically, you know, we get that. We haven't met him, but we know he's an asshole.
It's a great introduction almost.
Yes. And I think that, at least for me, I mean, that was a point where I thought, okay, this, you know, this is different. This is interesting now. And then obviously, you know, they worked with that. The other thing, which we can maybe mention even before, because it takes a long time before we actually meet Sherlock Holmes, is John Watson meeting Stamford, obviously. And just rewatching it now, it is so heartwarming to see how happy Stamford is as a person. Like, he's always smiling at Watson. Like, it doesn't matter. You know, John is super bitter about everything in this conversation. He's just, you know, he's not a happy man. And Stamford, he just doesn't care. You know, he's this bright, you know, ray of sunshine, and he's just smiling at everything he's saying and taking, you know, things not very personally. And they're in the middle of London. They're not in the Criterion, obviously.
But well, didn't they have that in the pilot episode?
Yes, exactly. But they did have the paper cups that say Criterion on the park bench. And so we get that little nod. I think it was too expensive to do it in the actual thing. After they paid all that money to do it in the pilot, I think they couldn't afford to do it again for Pink.
Only that, I think it actually, for it being the modern times, and John's supposed to be, you know, this poor guy. I'm presuming he's poor because, I mean, he can hardly afford to live in London. I can hardly afford to live in London. So it's a lot more plausible that Stamford would run into him at a park. I mean, especially someone like John, I think, with, again, this is just going off my experiences seeing people with PTSD, but I imagine small and enclosed places might not work for him. So he's more likely to be out on a walk in a park. And that's more often than not, you'll run into someone, you know, out there.
When I first moved to New York, and even now, especially when you're on a budget, like, there were more times, if you're going to spend the middle of an afternoon or whatnot, especially if you're broke, the chances of, that actually threw me off in the pilot, because I was like, it doesn't really make sense that you can't afford a roommate, but you're in a really nice restaurant or a really nice coffee shop. Mm-hmm. And seeing him on a park bench, kind of listless after you get that tiny apartment, and then running into Stamford there makes absolute sense, because that happens to me all the time in a big city where I'll be sitting on a park bench and I've run into people from high school. I've run into people that I haven't seen in 20 years who I never thought I would ever see again, because there are only so many central parks, even in London or where not.
Yeah.
That, I mean, mm-hmm. there's thousands, but at the same time, for some reason, you end up towards ones that you know. And if he had gone to Bart's and he had spent time there, likely chances he'd go back to places that he had spent time at. So it made sense that he would have just gotten back to London, gone back to some place that he probably went to when he was a student, and that's where he happened to run into somebody that he hadn't seen in a while who was just walking to work. So the believableness of it kind of came across more so, and I completely bought into it that he would have just run into Stamford.
You know, the notion that I love about the canon is just how present London is, and London is so present in the series as well. So I was sold to Sherlock before I'd met Sherlock, just because of that, just because of the whole beginning of how, you know, what you see of London. Of course, you also have the shots of London in the little intro trailer thingy. And then, of course, yes, the very sort of normal conversation that they're having. There's nothing superficial about this. It's just, you know, old friends, colleagues meeting in the park. Discussing how different their life has gone since then. And then sort of, you know, we meet Sherlock for the first time, which is pretty much the same way that that they introduced it in the pilot. But obviously what we have, which I was really thankful for, is we have an actual chemical experiment when they really meet for the first time, which doesn't exist in the pilot because they're just like in the computer room and Sherlock's just sending off emails. So I really love that they actually like have him doing his little hemoglobin experiment, which he's doing in studying Scarlet.
I want to just throw something in, which is that I think what struck me is that even before we really meet Sherlock full on, we know exactly who John Watson is. And of course, that has deepened and increased through the series. But honestly, from seeing, you know, Martin Freeman as Watson for about 2 minutes, I knew who this man was. Mm-hmm. And we've said on this podcast probably full on hours of just things that we love about Martin's portrayal. But honestly, I was captivated even without Sherlock Holmes being there. And to me, that says an amazing amount about the writing of Watson and the portrayal of how Martin acts Watson. That Watson is 100% an equal part of this. It's not Sherlock minus something. It's, you know, it's not like Sherlock and everyone else is a supporting player.
Yes.
It's Holmes and it's Watson. And I was already captivated before I had even seen Sherlock Holmes. And I think for me, that was the thing that gripped me and hooked me. And I went, you know, I know that I'm going to love Sherlock Holmes in this because I was already a fan of Benedict's work. And I knew who Martin was a little bit, but I'd never seen him do anything that serious. And watching that, I thought, okay, I already know who this man is, and I know that I want to watch a series.
Okay, so now let's talk about Sherlock and his the first impressions you had of him and sort of the first scenes getting to know John.
I didn't like him at first, admittedly, because I get Jeremy Brett was my Holmes, and he still is my Holmes, and I was kind of imagining that when they're like, yeah, this is Sherlock Holmes. This is kind of why I put off watching BBC Sherlock for so long. I'm like, he didn't look anything like Sherlock. But then he started doing his thing with deducing the eyes and the cheekbones and the winky thingy, whatever. And he grew on me. That's the best way I can describe it. He grew. Their affection was earned. I mean, as I continued watching the series, I fell more and more in love. I'm like, yeah, you guys are a pretty good, you know, example of Holmes and Watson.
For me, it was actually, I remember distinctly after the deduction and as soon as he got out of the cab, after we first met him and after they've had that whole little bit and you've gotten to the point where he's deduced John and whatnot and leaves him. And I remember with that, I actually paused it and I went and I made like 3 phone calls. And I think I actually have a post on LiveJournal that even where I was like, I don't care. Stop watching. I'm not even done. But everyone needs to watch this series. Because for me, I think that was the part of Holmes that I had always connected to. It was one reason why I read canon. Like when I read the canon, I have to break it up or whatnot, because I was always more about that moment for me of when Holmes makes the deduction or Holmes reveals his disguise or when Holmes does some thing that's out of the ordinary and also kind of makes you want to simultaneously slap him and kiss him. And you had between the rungs that we got earlier, this little glimpse, and now this moment where he did the deduction exactly like I had always pictured in my head of, I'm giving you the information because this is everything that's just gone through what I have seen, and I'm dumping it on you. And, oh, I might have offended you, but who really cares because I'm Sherlock Holmes. And you had that all at once with no apologies, no, now we're going to explain it. It was a, here it is, and now we're cutting, and now we're going on. And that, for me, also came off as both great filmmaking and also just, I was like, you're actually giving me a Holmes that I've always wanted to see on the film and television that I feel like I've never quite gotten to this degree. And it's one of the reasons why I always say that Study in Pink is probably the first, like, 20 minutes of A Study in Pink is probably my favorite adaptation of any canon Holmes, because I always felt it did such a great job at taking it and putting it onto the screen and giving you kind of the essence of what John Watson and Sherlock Holmes is.
And it's also the first time that John Watson actually smiles, which I noticed today. Aww. For the first time. So it's, you know, after...
He has, like, a little ball of sunshine.
Yeah, it's, like, after the piss-off one it's literally the first time, like, since we met John Watson in that, you know, in that episode, that he smiles, that he cracks a smile. And it's just, you know, that's the moment where you know, okay, Sherlock Holmes is confused because there's someone who actually likes him. So that is, you know, that is sort of the beginning of the friendship, because it felt before that quite obviously Sherlock is really sort of trying to push his buttons and trying to figure out how far he can go with them. So this whole sort of, you know, getting to know each other thing, and he's, you know, he's withholding information on purpose just to see what happens. And that is the moment where he thinks, okay, you know, I can, you know, I can do whatever. He will follow me. So I think that is a decisive moment, and not only the deduction itself. And then obviously, you know, John being amused that he gets Harriet wrong, which establishes, you know, that friendship. So I really enjoyed sort of rewatching that.
And Benedict also plays the moment so well of conveying how Sherlock appreciates, you know, he thrives upon an audience, he craves an audience, but he's also, he does these little, like, sideways look that I think I could see where it led into the Otter meme, but especially when John offers him his phone in the lab, and they sort of light Benedict, like, across one cheekbone, and his eyebrow sort of goes up, and he's like, huh, this is interesting, this is a bump in the monotony. And then, you know, he thanks him for the phone, and then we go off to the deduction scene. So there's the moment in the lab where you can see, you know, Benedict is embodying how Sherlock is not just excited on an egotistical level to have an audience, but also he's intrigued enough by this audience that he wants to pursue it, pursue the questioning and that investigation, which I think is on two separate levels. And as well, after he does that phenomenal scene in the cab, and then John just sort of, you know, laughs and shrugs, they do the same, they light Benedict the same way again, where he's sort of half in shadow, half in light, and he's just like, and his eyebrow is quirked, he's pondering, and it's very endearing, and they always juxtapose it right before, at least in the first half hour, it bookends either right before or right after these incredibly fluid deduction scenes, where it could tip over into total assholery. what have you. But they I don't know, they soften it, but they temper it. And it's something, again, that because every visual element is handled so carefully, I think in a way it amplifies it in a way that the text can't do. Not to be heretical. But it does convey it conveys that yearning for an audience, but for stimulus in a way that makes Holmes seem worthy of Watson's following him.
I actually, to go to my first impression or whatever, I had really high hopes, and I had somewhat specific expectations, and maybe this is kind of unusual, but I really fancied Benedict in the film Amazing Grace. He played William Younger, who was close friends with William Wilberforce, and they had a bit of a Holmes and Watson dynamic, to be honest. And there were some very Holmes moments in the way that he played Pitt the Younger. He was kind of very acerbic, but he also always kind of had that twinkle in his eye and that wink waiting to happen. And so I came into Sherlock hoping that he was going to bring that in, but at the same time thinking, I know this is modern. How are they going to work the stylization of the character into the context? And I think Maria and I obviously were on the unaired pilot reaction, and I think that the aired version of Pink does a more seamless job with that. We're still seeing, obviously, a modern context that works really well, but we're also seeing a Sherlock Holmes who is still recognizably the character that we're expecting. And, you know, with some of the some adaptations or whatever don't track with that as well for me personally. So I think for me, it was a sigh of relief of going, okay, I like the way he's playing this. I like that he's still this sort of odd, quirky character that maybe doesn't seem like a normal person for this day and time, but yet he really doesn't need to seem like a normal person for any day and time.
Yeah,
he's just Sherlock Holmes, and he's a timeless character. And I love the same things that all of you guys love. I love particularly that moment where you have that, basically the ice breaks, because they both realize that they have this sort of off, weird sense of humor that they can share with each other. And I think that's a huge moment. They're both laughing and they're both smiling, and you realize, okay, both of these people are really quite odd on their own, but together they share something that only the two of them basically share.
Which brings us to the crime scene and Donovan, who's not very happy about, well, Sherlock Holmes showing up, even less happy about, you know, him having a friend over.
Yeah, I want to shout out to Vinette Robinson because that is one of the main changes in cast from the unaired pilot to the series. And obviously she brings a huge amount of, independence and a lot of like strength of character to Sally. So shout out to her.
Yeah, absolutely. She's amazing. And she's a super amazing sort of counterpart to, she's the critic. We know Lestrade sort of, hopes for the best and closes his eyes and, he's just there. Anderson is just, he doesn't like him at all. But Donovan, she's a proper critic and she's really careful. And I mean, obviously that develops throughout the series, but I think there's a reason why she keeps her job and Anderson doesn't, because she's much more level-headed and she knows that, that Sherlock is a strange person and that he can be potentially dangerous. And she's not wrong about this. So I really hugely appreciate to sort of have her as this counterforce, as the only proper critic of Sherlock, apart from John, obviously, in the series.
And it's also nice because Lestrade is more, compared to especially canonically necessarily, he comes off as more the one that Sherlock does get along with in the yard and is respected a little bit. Donovan is that nice voice of all of the other inspectors that you see throughout the whole series who have some respect for Sherlock, but also very much dislike him and very much a lot of times want to put him in his place. Yeah. Because Lestrade doesn't tend to put Holmes in his place in Sherlock BBC, but Donovan does. And Donovan is competent enough for you to accept her and actually still like her for doing so, that gives you that kind of back and forth that he has with the Yard in canon frequently.
Absolutely.
I remember thinking after I'd just seen this episode that Donovan and to a lesser extent Anderson, and even their last names are sort of, they're sort of resonant together. And that's shown up in such a funny way in the dialogue, that they're kind of like a Greek chorus, more or less successful, and very clearly laid out who's the most effective. No, only one person gets told to face the other side, so they don't put the whole block off. But and just thinking later, of course, in Reichenbach, where everyone is sort of assigned these, the king is surrounded by these advisors, and that's Lestrade sort of beleaguered with Donovan and Anderson leading the pack, the chorus against Holmes, is that even is tying back into the apple and sort of the structure, the mythological structure, the literary structure that's laid onto the filming. Because initially, that was the most fantastical element to me, that Donovan could get away with talking to and about her boss in front of her boss, and to this consultant that her boss has given leeway towards. But then, of course, it makes perfect sense with every other element. You have to have Watson and Holmes being this way. And then if you're going to have a pushback, as Tiffany said, it should be someone as strong as Donovan and inhabited by that personality. But initially, it struck me as like too broad, which is sort of funny in retrospect. Like, that was the thing that I thought was a little over the top.
I think all of us are quite angry with her, aren't we? I mean, I know a lot of people in the fandom don't like
Donovan. Well, yeah, because she calls him a freak. She's immediately hostile towards him. And I mean, it took a long while before we all thought, well, maybe there's a history there. And especially when Sherlock was, it was quite vicious of him to deduce the relationship between her and Anderson, the way he goes, well, she smells like your deodorant, and going, the part that got me is when he says, going by the state of her knees, cleaning your floor, and you're just like, wow, that was kind of mean.
Yeah.
And then you realize that, maybe that hostility towards him is not unfounded, that there's a reason behind it. Although, as, John is constantly with Sherlock, then you kind of notice it kind of softens him a little bit. But before that, I can only imagine how Sherlock was without somebody there to tell him that was a bit not good.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, in that scene, while he's deducing the state of Donovan's knees, he's also doing what he does in the canon. He's checking, the ground, he's looking above, in a very sort of subtle way, but it's hugely important in studying Scarlet, right, where he's sort of making fun, he's actually sort of not making fun, he's very angry. When he comes to the crime scene, he notices that, there are no tracks because police officers basically walked all over the place. And even though he's not sort of bitching at the police for that reason, he finds a different reason to be angry with them, basically on a much more personal level than having contaminated the crime scene. But he is doing the look, like he's searching. Which I really appreciated that they sort of had that put in, that between sort of crossing the police tape line and going in, he's actually sort of really having a look around.
I also have to say, in Donovan's defense, one of the things that when I saw it that I also had gone through my head was the fact that she's like one of the only females that you see that's of an upper level on the force. And on top of it, you get this automatic attitude that she's had to put up with so much over the years to get to that point, especially with Anderson. And then on top of it, actually doing what I'm sure she's been accused of with other people of, you know, that whole idea of sleeping your way to the top, and to have Holmes come in and automatically deduce it, which in this case is true, although it's not the top level, it's almost the opposite way around in this situation. But to have that, the idea that she called him a freak and then she was saying you should stay away from him, I don't know. If I were in her position and I had somebody who's now a man who isn't even working for the force officially come in and try to tell me all of my business when I've worked so hard to get to that point and dealing with all of that kind of BS, I don't know. You know, it's one situation where she can call him that and not get reprimanded for it because he's not technically the yard, versus if she were to tell somebody on the yard that or actually speak her mind, the chances of her getting either demoted and or fired are statistically higher.
Absolutely. So I think from a feminist point of view, you know, applause for her.
I think there was a fan fiction I read that actually went into a really good theory of why she's like that. And I think in there she had told him that it's always easy for him, that he just waltzes in there. They just let him do whatever the hell he wants just because he's so brilliant. And she points out that, like you guys were saying, that she worked her ass off to get to where she's at. And then he just comes in there and just, you know, says things like that. And then she also went on to say that sometimes she's fearful of him because of that intelligence, which I think is a great way. I mean, look at Moriarty. Moriarty is what Sherlock would have been if he would have gone to the dark side. So I think it's almost that natural instinct to fear such a fierce intellect like that, which I think makes her an amazing character. I know she gets so much crap, but she is such a strong woman. She is powerful. She is not afraid to, like, I'm pretty sure she would punch Sherlock in the face and not feel bad about it. And I don't know. She is, like, she grew on me as well. Like, I like her. I know at first, yeah, I was like, oh, why are you being so mean to him? And then I was like, you know, maybe you have a reason to be kind of mean.
Well, now we can move on to Jennifer Wilson.
Just is strictly from a graphic designing point of view, I like the text. I like the way they did the deduction. And that's simply because for a moment, I felt like I was inside Sherlock's head. And I think it was a great way to illustrate how he does his deductions. Like, it basically slowed everything down. It's like he's looking at this, he's looking at that, and it was going through, like, the steps that he was taking to reach the conclusions that he was getting to. In a way, I mean, it didn't outright tell us the answer, but it was showing us he saw all these clues, and so we're seeing everything, and then that's when he stands up and he's like, boom, this is what I came up with. I liked it, the way it was shot. I liked the way that the text rolled in. It was also beautifully done.
Yeah, and we have obviously John asking the question, you know, we need him in the canon, and we need him then to ask, you know, I have no idea what's happening, please tell us. And you know, while Sherlock makes fun of Lestrade for not understanding or for even thinking, he answers John, even though he makes fun of him, but, you know, he still answers him, which is important because otherwise we would never know. So sort of that relationship is still exactly the same from the canon to...
There is a visual difference I wanted to mention that seems small, but I actually think is really important. In the unaired pilot, Sherlock actually puts on, like, the forensic suit so he doesn't contaminate the crime scene. And that's not something, obviously, that he does in Pink. And I mean, it's arguably kind of a small thing, but I think it visually works better. I saw the aired episode before the pilot, as most people did. And it seemed... there's something strange about him being that conformist.
Yeah.
Whether or not you want to argue about realism or whatever, I think there's something for me that really works about Sherlock never being out of Sherlock's uniform, so to speak. Like, he always looks different from the police. He never looks exactly like a regular officer, even officers in plain clothes. And so for me, visually, I love that we have Sherlock coming in. He's still him. He still looks exactly the same. It's like he's taking control of this crime scene, regardless of whether Lestrade or, you know, the Yard thinks that they're in charge of this crime scene. The person who's now in charge of this is Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
The one person, as you guys have just been saying, the one person that he's willing to actually communicate with in a serious way is John Watson. John Watson has already become the one voice that actually gets through to him mentally when he's thinking like that. he doesn't really care what anyone else is saying at that point, but he does care what John Watson is saying. And I think just that iconic partnership where we see them solving a crime together that first time, dressed like they're normally dressed. You know, we see the text on screen. It's so iconic that it sets up something that basically shows us what we're going to get for the rest of the series, which is just incredibly important.
Yeah. And I think we mentioned the Batman scene last time when we talked about the on-air pilot. But I think the fact that Sherlock gets to keep his coat on in that scene is sort of a substitute for that kind of worship thing that's going on. Because, you know, now he can sort of like swish it around and be all fancy with it and, you know, look all pretty. You know, Watson is not as obvious in his admiration in that moment, but he gets to show off in a more realistic way, even though it's not realistic in terms of crime scenes, but in a more sort of normal way than the against the moon in the rain.
Yeah, if you haven't watched the pilot in a while, it's that shot where he's like, yeah, he's like up on high against the moon and there's like super dramatic music and John has like the heart eyes emojis and like, yeah. And Stephen Moffat said he was really sad to lose that shot. So maybe the pink scene is his like consolation prize.
I would also say that it's an exact like response to the whole, because you had that conversation of the police don't consult amateurs. And the idea that Watson comes in and says, well, what about you, when he tells him to put on the robe? And instead, Holmes just marches in without any kind of word in his full outfit, and no one even bats an eye necessarily. I mean, there's a little of it, but not enough. And then in that response to it proves his point that I'm the one like who they do, in fact, have to call. And I'm the one at the end of the day that I know what I'm doing, to the point that I don't have to conform whatsoever. Taking that from there, also, it also helps that audience members, especially people who may not be familiar with Sherlock Holmes as much, or who on a whole are just watching it from a crime drama aspect, set dressing and everything else, costuming wise, there's no denying that it draws your eye immediately when you've got Holmes in the center, not wearing normal clothes, you've got the woman in pink, and then you have everybody else in these blue jumpsuits. Your eye is not going to be drawn to anyone else. It's all drawn to Holmes, and all your attention's taken there, even when the conversation isn't necessarily around him, which I think really helps from a cinematography view. Like, I know that was what made that scene for me. It was so symmetrically aligned that you couldn't deny, you didn't have that at all when you had the pilot and everyone wearing the same kind of outfit.
And Lestrade is just giving up. I mean, he's just sort of crumbling. He's just, you know, he's saying, okay, you know, you do whatever you need to do. And then, obviously, it's also very important for John because, you know, once Lestrade lets him, you know, examine the corpse, then, you know, that means that John is in as well. Right? Without, Lestrade doesn't know who he is. He doesn't even know his name. I mean, he knows his first name because Sherlock called him that. But, you know, he doesn't know who the hell just walked in with Sherlock Holmes. And he trusts Sherlock to that extent that he just lets a random stranger, whom he doesn't even know, you know, what's going on, to like get close to the body. So that tells us a lot, I think, about the history that Lestrade and Sherlock have that is not really, you know, mentioned. But still, you know, it gives us a lot of background information in just, you know, a single scene about how these characters work with each other.
Well, and there's something we kind of skipped over, which is there's a general idea of this being true, that if Sherlock may seem kind of like a jerk on the surface, but people who really know him really trust him. Like, Mrs. Hudson trusts John Watson because of Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, true.
And when we have, you know, the visit to 221B, and we have kind of that really touching scene with Mrs. Hudson, where we see that there is someone that Sherlock Holmes is actually really nice to, for the most part. She accepts John Watson, and that, of course, is where we have the call for them to come to the crime scene. But I think in a couple of different subtle ways, we see that Sherlock is a polarizing person. People who know him either love him or they hate him. He's not somebody that people kind of stay in between on.
Yeah.
And so I think it's that idea that once you've been picked by Sherlock Holmes, you have this kind of key to all these other people and all these other situations.
Since we were talking about the sort of the moving in scene, for the first time today, I was wondering, where the hell did Sherlock keep all of that stuff before he moved in? Because, I mean, you know, he filled that entire flat with his shit. How? How and why?
Magic. Maybe he just like opened it up and brought a bunch of stuff out. I don't know. They I mean, he's always described as the bohemian soul, his place full of clutter and
Arwell has even commented before, saying that when they were filling the flat up, they literally had to go look everywhere so they can continue to keep, you know, make it look more cluttered. Because, I mean, that's the shot he was going for, this cluttery flat that John's in here like, the hell is all this mess? Because, I mean, we have John with nothing and then Sherlock with crap everywhere.
Yeah.
And then the happy middle once they move in together.
It makes you wonder whether that's the reason why he was evicted before. It's just too much probably. Stuff.
And also, if you look at his bedroom, there's like nothing in his bedroom except his clothes. So like, it's quite obvious that everything he has, instead of doing what normal people do, which is spreading it through various rooms, is like, let me put everything in the sitting room.
Well, if you think about it, and this is the same way I am. The way I am is my bedroom, typically where, like, I don't spend very, like, this, I'm talking from my parents' house, because here my bedroom acts as my whole apartment. But when I'm with my parents, my bedroom is spotless. It's neat and tidy because I don't spend a lot of time in there. Meanwhile, the kitchen and everywhere else that I happen to occupy, my mom says it. She goes, I always know when you're visiting because everywhere else that you're at, there is clutter everywhere. There's papers, there's different weird things that you're doing, new crafts that you're up to. Just crap goes everywhere else, but your room is spotless. Maybe that's what Sherlock... Well, Sherlock doesn't spend a lot of time in the bedroom, I don't imagine. In several different ways.
Keep talking.
in this version, no.
In this version, not at all. No, I mean, he's never in his room. I think it makes sense that it'd be fairly neat.
It's so homey, the way they've set it up. Like, it's just going back that Holmes is his own sort of, you know, I forget who said he's polarizing, but he also is his own universe, and he inexorably drags people in. And so there's so many shots of him surrounded by people. You know, he's the center of attention, or he's initially on the fringes and then it shifts to him. But then even the, you know, thinking about the sitting room, and then when the drugs bust takes place, and there are all these people milling around because they're very keen, which is one of my favorite lines from the entire series, is that he's, you know, try as he might even to sort of instill this order and have the universe operate the way he wants it to, he's forced to interact with people. He's really not isolated. Every time he encounters someone, it sets him, you know, it has reverberations for his deductions and also just for the way he interacts with Watson. So it's like this whole reciprocal, is he softening up? Is he holding his distance? It's just, I find those interactions, again, are so well traced out by the staging and the blocking in all of those group scenes.
Just to tag on to what she was saying, you know, there's obviously this stuff in the canon about Holmes, Watson thinking of Holmes as being someone who could have been a famous figure on the London stage. I think the show does a fantastic job, especially in these early scenes, of making Sherlock this kind of, he's the star, he's the flamboyant, like we see that flamboyance of this person who wants everyone to think that he's this cold, calculating, reasoning machine, but he loves this audience and he loves the attention of it to some extent. Like, you know, in all these scenes, he does love kind of, well, it's like Watson says later, you know, turning up your collar so you look cool.
Yeah,
he's a drama queen.
Yeah, he is. He's a total drama queen. And we see so many of these scenes where everyone is standing around and Sherlock is like walking around swishing his coat or like thinking. And, you know, it's so funny because it's like he's definitely his own kind of thing that everybody else is orbiting around.
We've jumped over to the drugs bust, but we're skipping one of my favorite men. What about Mycroft when they met, when he was introduced? I mean, come on, him with this whole, I think it's a Holmes thing to be dramatic. If they could carry a smoke machine, like, in their, I don't know where.
Yes,
you know, it's like, cue that. Because God knows they love to present a silhouette, Mycroft, with the driving up and standing there and like, man, look at me, kind of scary.
But that John is just like, you know, well, thank God you're above all that. And it's just the perfect response ever to anything of any, you know, action the Holmes brothers take.
John is just, he's like built to deal with Holmes, because even looking at Mycroft, he's like, you know, you're not very scary. Like, yeah. Nice try.
I mentioned this to Amy before, how similar Watson and Mycroft are sort of pitched against each other in that scene, because we have Mycroft with the umbrella, right? So he's sort of standing there having the umbrella in one hand, and then we have Watson coming up having his cane in the other hand. So basically they're standing face to face with the exact, like, if it was dark and you couldn't really see, you wouldn't be able to tell who's who because they look so much the same. in the way that sort of they're a reflection of each other, a mirror image. And what is interesting, I find, is that John obviously, you know, manages to get rid of the limb and the cane, therefore whereas Mycroft, even now, still has his umbrella, which might tell us a lot about, you know, getting close to Sherlock Holmes and, you know, sort of figuring him out. And because Mycroft, even in The Abominable Bride, he, you know, he's still not quite close to Sherlock. There's still this distance, there's still the difficulties that they have, but, you know, John very quickly manages to get over that distance, and I think it's perfectly represented by, you know, the two sticky devices that they both carry around, and which really draws up a parallel between them.
Well, them meeting, it's almost like the passing of the torch, which is why in The Abominable Bride it really got me. Mycroft is like, take care of him. In this case, it's almost the same thing. He's like, well, you're moving in with him. Can we, you know, expect a happy announcement? Because he's very suspicious of this guy. Like, everybody seems to be puzzled. And how the hell did Sherlock Holmes find a friend? Because it seems to be such a strange thought. But Mycroft approved of him in his own strange, dramatic sort of way.
Yeah.
And it almost feels like it was a passing of the torch of like, hey, my little brother's in your hands. I'll be watching you.
Yeah, and he's doing that almost in every season at some point. Like, there's always this weird, weird meeting between Mycroft and John. And it always ends with John being upset with him because he put Sherlock in danger, and then Mycroft basically just going, no, I fucked up, please can you take care of
him? Exactly. Although, you know, when we first met Mycroft, I thought for a second he was Moriarty, and I was like, wow, this is a pretty quick introduction. And it was simply because the way they presented him was very villain-like. I mean, come on, kidnapping John off the street, bringing him to an abandoned warehouse, striking silhouette and a freaking umbrella. I mean, it was setting him up to be like a super villain. And then that's why it made the punchline at the end of like, I don't know, that's my brother. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
That what? Excuse me? That's your brother? Of course. It all makes sense now. You're so dramatic. My God.
Yeah. But on the other hand, it gives John so much strength. Because, you know, of all the people, and even Sherlock saying, you know, he's the most dangerous man you've ever met, John doesn't give a fuck. You know, he doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't want to take his money. He's not really scared. I mean, he's sort of intimidated. So it shows John's strength, because we have, you know, the most dangerous man he's ever met. And John doesn't, you know, he doesn't give a fuck about what Mycroft has to say to him, until obviously we have the whole, you know, pulling out the notes that his therapist took. But even then, you know, when after the whole scene of, you know, show me your left hand, John is obviously sort of not okay with Mycroft touching him. And, you know, there's definitely a moment of sort of fear and mistrust there. But he, you know, he has this smile when he realizes that his hand really isn't shaking anymore. So he goes out of that encounter the stronger man of the two. Mycroft being set up as the supervillain and to, you know, be kept as the secret until the end of the episode also serves to draw up John Watson as a true, you know, a truly strong character, which I love about this, that it gives him the chance to, you know, just be angry, be beautiful while he's, you know, he is being angry, and to just walk away from this and then also flirt with Anthea again.
Oh, God. It was also interesting to me because there was that little lapse in between, and you're starting to move away a little bit from how the canon story went, and instead taking its own path. And this was a nice little intermediary, because I remember having that same thought of, oh, this is Moriarty. And then it went a little bit further, and I was like, this isn't quite coming off as Moriarty. And I was like, is this Mycroft? And then I was like, actually, it's coming off as a Bond villain. And then I was like, oh, so it must be Mycroft. But I felt like it was a nice little guessing game to put in there, a nudge for people who weren't familiar with the series could just take it for what it is, oh, we're getting either a villain, which made the punchline all the better, and also gave people who hadn't seen the series or even knew anything about Sherlock Holmes or that he had a brother this whole, like, oh my goodness, if that's how his brother acts. But for the people who had read the books and who had that familiarity, like Gatiss and Moffat both do, this kind of also little, like, nice little twinge of, all right, now we've got something else making your brains roll for the rest of the series of, who is this? Is this Mycroft? Is this, here are all these little hints that we're throwing at you. Go ahead and go with it. I think I had decided when we got back and Holmes just kind of blew him off, I was like, okay, I'm going to root that this is Mycroft. But it also made it all the better at the end of making me want more, because I had that secondary level of mystery that was now added and a puzzle for me to solve.
Absolutely.
What I want to add is I actually think a lot of this segment of this episode has been completely reframed by things later in the series. When I was rewatching Pink just now, in the drugs bust scene, everyone comes and Watson's response is like, it's totally incredulous. He's like, there's no way that a guy like this would ever have any of this. And, you know, Sherlock is basically like, stop talking now. And obviously, if you're someone who is familiar with the canon or with even with other adaptations, we all know, you know, the history of Sherlock Holmes and the 7% solution, etc. But for people who didn't, obviously that was a mystery. And early on, obviously the drugs weren't as huge of an issue, but I also think it reframed the meeting with Mycroft, because we now know that Mycroft is not just a weirdo. I mean, he is a weirdo, but he's also a guy who's had to pull his brother out of various drug houses and has been looking out for, to whatever extent, an addict brother for several years. And so I feel like both the drugs bust and this scene are actually less light and less humorous once you see the following episodes. Because going back and watching them now, I see, okay, this is somebody who is legitimately someone who has had not only addictions, but also addiction relapses. And this is a brother who, in his own weird way, is probably incredibly concerned about anyone his brother is hanging out with, because he's someone who's had to be that person so many times. And I think it touches me more than ever that he does trust John Watson, because he sees John Watson as someone who isn't going to give up on Sherlock and who will be there. And so I think some of those things that even at the time might have been intended to be a little lighter or a little funnier have ended up being part of an overall story arc of kind of the Holmes family and then Watson as kind of a almost family member, that it just, it really affects my impression of who Mycroft is in this episode, being really strange, obviously, but also having to deal with this history that he's had with Sherlock and not being close enough to get there, not being able to be that friend himself, but probably hoping in some sense that Sherlock will find someone who can help him basically be the best version of himself.
Absolutely.
Which I think was really, it was really illustrated, I think, in the Bride episode, that, because I mean, it gave me intense feels that whole episode when I was watching that, and it brought me back to this first episode where you realize when he's saying that he's worried about him and he's concerned and all that, he genuinely and truly is worried about his brother. So yeah, meeting John, like this fellow who suddenly he's moving in, and naturally he'll be worried because Sherlock seems to attract danger. And in his own way, John is danger, as people often describe him. He's rage and danger and a little knitted jumper, which I think is quite an accurate description of him. So Mycroft just gives me feelings. And I mean, we saw his more protectives too in other episodes when he was warning Sherlock when he said Redbeard, things like that. I mean, he's your typical older brother. He means well, and he's not always going to do well, but he's trying in his awkward Holmesian way.
Yeah, and you get sort of the snarky relationship they have, because once John comes home after being summoned by him, right, sort of interrupting the text, interrupting the conversation between Mycroft and John, which I love that John is checking his phone. He just, you know, he doesn't care that Mycroft's talking to him at the moment. He's just, you know, checking his phone for the messages. And he comes home, and then Sherlock says why you offered money to spy on me, and then pity you can split the fee. So that very, very nicely illustrates the kind of snarky relationship they have, which is then of course picked up on later on throughout the series. But of course it also, you know, we still don't have the answer, it's still a mystery, and it's not, you know, we sort of cut off because, you know, Sherlock decides not to tell John, and this is one of the scenes which still sort of, it puts my hair on end, because he is pushing John's buttons so hard in that scene, right? So he's waiting, he's telling him he needs his phone, then he says, you know, I was shouting at Mrs. Hudson but she didn't hear me. So he's basically just lying around on the couch, you know, having the three-patch problem going on. And he's just being an ass, like, right out. He could, you know, he could take John's phone and do the thing and then explain, but he doesn't. He, you know, he has him, you know, give him the phone, then he brings it back and says, you know, tells him to send the text, and then he's sort of being really, really, well, too quick about it all, overwhelming John. But in the end, you know, it's another test, I think, it's another test, just to see how far he can take it with John. And then even when the suitcase, or he brings up the suitcase, and John's just sort of staring at him, not quite knowing what to think, Shrug is mentioning, you know, the maybe I should say that I am not the murderer. And then John actually asks, sort of honestly, if that is something that people usually presume. So there we, again, even though he's definitely, he's just, you know, he's been really annoyed for the past 10 minutes by Sherlock Holmes personally, to a degree where I would be super angry. And we know now that John is an angry person, but he's, you know, he's holding back because he's generally interested in what the hell is going on and what Sherlock is doing with that suitcase. So it balances nicely the professional interest he's taking in this, and also in Sherlock as a person, in a way, balances out his annoyance in this moment. It's John who is, you know, who's willing to ignore all of that stuff that Sherlock's doing to him in order to get to the secret. So he's, you know, he's asking the questions that we need to ask him to be able to understand the case. And that's exactly, again, him being that person asking those questions.
I love that sequence in part because I felt like it was what took the place of John Watson's list. Because you have the list in the book of these are the things that Holmes does, these are the things that Holmes knows, these are the things that I don't understand about this person and I'm trying to work out. And I feel that you get so much of that in this little bit of segment of between the three patches and him, you know, lying and not talking to people for days at end, and with the whole suitcase and with the caught inside his brain and all of these little moments that you see there that kind of make up a lot of the lists of what you're given almost from the get-go in the book. But because, I mean, you could do that. You could do a kind of narrative that so many Holmes adaptations do, but instead here you're illustrating it for people since you don't have that couple weeks or however many how many months that usually you have between when Watson moves in and Holmes actually takes the case. Here you have that expanse in 3 days or in two days. And you get that list almost automatically by having him pulled back in. And here you have the worst of Holmes on display. But at the end of the day, you still have Watson even knowing what the profession is in this situation, which, you know, in the books, he doesn't. He sees people coming in constantly and he doesn't quite know, like, what's going on. Mm. And here you have that, you know, right off the bat, oh, he's a consulting detective. And you could easily lose interest or just put off everything as eccentricism as a result. But by giving us all of these little bad habits or these little issues that you have and things that Holmes does that aren't quite in the norm, now you have this ability to watch Watson trying to work everything out and how Holmes has his thought process. And I thought that was a nice way to tie that in, and giving us all of those aspects of Holmes in a shorter amount of time without trying to draw out the case to a longer expansion.
Yeah, that's true. Like this weird way where Watson doesn't really quite know what's going on in the second and third chapter of Study in Scarlet is pretty much condensed into those few moments. That's true. Okay, let's move on to Angelo's. A thought I had today when I was rewatching is that Shrug must have texted him because Billy, who's obviously, you know, a link again to the boy working for Mrs. Hudson in the canon, who's basically just like the doorman or waiter in Angelo's, he's picking off like a reservation sign of a table. So like that shed a whole new light on the date aspect, and it explains possibly why Angelo thinks that John is his date. I never noticed that before.
Well, again, it also ties into how I think people seem constantly surprised in this episode that Sherlock has somebody with him. And I think that is what keeps surprising all of them. It's why Angela immediately had to assume like the only way Sherlock would have anybody with him is he's dating them. I mean, Hudson she took that leap as well. People are just surprised that there's somebody who can stand to be around Sherlock Holmes and not be punching him in the face or calling him names or anything. I mean, Lestrade tolerates him. He's like a necessary evil, and on some level he does like Sherlock, but John's around him and he doesn't seem to mind Sherlock's abrasive nature. He doesn't seem to mind that he can be a complete asshole, like you guys were just saying, that he pretty much tried overwhelming John, seeing how far can I push him, like make him do this, make him do that, and John's still there.
Yeah.
So then we get to Angelo's, and oh, God bless that awkward talk. Oh, it makes me cringe just thinking about it. With the, like, I mean, come on. So you got a girlfriend? No. Boyfriend? It's like, oh, the whole bit was just like, that's so, it made me, it gives me secondhand embarrassment. I'm getting embarrassed.
I think that's how everyone feels about this scene.
Yeah, I love it for the comic relief. Obviously, there are great details about characters there, but there are so many funny things in the Holmes canon, and I think there are intermittent things in this episode that are nods to some of the funnier things. Like, obviously, that conversation is, like, cringeworthy, hilarious. But also the whole fact of who Angelo is and why he likes Sherlock is hysterical, and it points to some of the sort of dark humor in Doyle, where, you know, Holmes is talking about how the most charming woman he ever knew, like, poisoned all of her children. Like, you know, there's like, some really understated, like, dark humor, and I love that they kind of nod to that now and then, that, like, you know, Sherlock Holmes is not, a laugh a minute in terms of a character, but he has there's just these absurd things, like Angelo saying that, you know, he got him off murder because he was committing a burglary somewhere else. Like, it's just, I don't know. I love that moment that we get because it's kind of a little lull in between when we're about to get, like, a huge amount of action, obviously. So
yeah.
I love
the
little comic relief there.
And I do enjoy popping out there and staring and then looking, like, God, they ran a lot because... And that's one thing I loved about John, is just like, and there goes Sherlock taking off running. And he's like, oh, I better go follow him and leap across buildings. I'm sorry, if somebody invited me out to go have dinner and then next thing they get up and, like, run out,
and
I would follow,
like,
them.
Over use and stuff.
Yeah, I'd follow them.
I don't know,
up
I'm on that.
Yeah, could I run in heels? I don't know. Let's see it happen. That entire film sequence was brilliantly shot, and I like the mixture of, they had the map and then they had them running and then the little flashing signs, and finally John's getting the thrill and the chase that he so craves.
Yeah,
and he takes off flying like he's like a bird that had its wing injured and now he can fly again. He's just like, whoa, yeah, danger, leaping off buildings. It was absolutely brilliant. And then of course the best line ever of welcome to London.
And, like, the pickpocketing Lestrade thing. It's just amazing. It's beautiful.
Lestrade just reminds me, like, of a father figure, almost. Like, reprimands Sherlock, and, oh, God, there he goes again. And, great, now he has somebody who's going to make him even worse. And
like, I wonder how many of your, what are those ideas, can you actually, like, get? Like, how does Lestrade explain a constant lack and loss of his ID?
They must think he's a forgetful person.
I'm like, Sherlock is like, oh, you can keep this one. I've got, like, a bunch at home.
Yes, definitely a favorite line. And John is just like, at that point, John's 100% in.
Yes.
He's just, like, cracking up at that point. He's like, I'm gone. I'm never going to get out of this situation ever again.
It almost, like, solidified the little friendship there. Like, he just took him on a run. I mean, there was no, in the end, I mean, they ran after the cab driver, nothing happened. And then, of course, they get back and they do that adorable, John has the funniest little giggle, or Martin, I should say. Oh, my God, baby, love, like, that's such a high-pitched giggle. Aha! And then, of course, the moment was shattered with the drugs bust. And I think that was why we went from John saw Sherlock in this brilliant light, this incredible, crazy man. And then we're brought into the drugs bust, and I think that's why Sherlock was like, please shut up, like, kind of like, don't uncover that side about me, not just yet, because, like, just a moment ago you thought I was brilliant, and now you might think, you know, I'm not that great,
yeah.
I'm actually quite human. And again, yeah, it was actually quite dark, in the sense of, you realize that at one point Sherlock was a drug addict, and it was a dark time in his history. I mean, even Lestrade's like, hey, let's just watch this whole thing, and freaking Anderson, oh, Anderson and his keen drive to look around the flat.
What I really appreciate about that scene is that the sensory overload that's going on with Sherlock is, like, is you can feel it because of the cuts that are being made, because of the noise, because of people, like, coming in, Mrs. Hudson showing up. It's almost like a play that is culminating in everybody coming on, you know, on the stage and sort of just shouting their thoughts out. It's almost like this modernist kind of stream of consciousness thing going on. So it's like you can physically feel how Sherlock is feeling as this scene just speeds up. right? So you have like, you have the running scene, which is sort of really quick, and then you have the really calm scene where they're giggling in the, you know, downstairs, and then Angela comes, and then it's again, it's like, it's like a car crash. It's, you know, it's speeding up, and then it's sort of just smashing against the wall, and then Troy just leaves because, you know, he obviously realizes what's going on. But I love that it's painful to watch this scene or to sort of listen.
I also think that's just something that this whole series is actually quite good at doing. Like I mentioned before, the deductions, that they have a way of just pulling you into his mind. Because I remember, and this is going backwards to when they discovered the Pink Lady, when they're all, that really pregnant pause and they're all staring. And then he said, shut up, I can hear you thinking. I almost apologize to the screen. Like, I'm sorry. Because I was just thinking to myself. And I think it's just something that they do brilliantly in this entire series, is they really stick you in his head. And for a minute, you know, you feel you're there. And very much like you said, when this is a drug busting, there's people everywhere, there's lights, there's sounds, Mrs. Hudson's talking, and it's a sensory overload. And then the chase scene, everything about this whole, I find, just the series in general, is we kind of have this nice balance of one minute we're kind of looking through John's eyes, the next minute we're looking through Sherlock's eyes. And I think it's a nice balance because you have to be curious about what goes on in that crazy head of Sherlock's. And, you know, what could it be like? And I think for the fact that you're feeling it almost physically, to have all this information coming at you, that for a minute you get to be Sherlock Holmes, is actually quite brilliant editing on their part.
Yeah. And I remember cheering at this moment because it had been fairly recently after the Robert Downey Jr. movie had been made. And one of the things that I loved the Robert Downey Jr. movies, but one of the things that really saddened me was when they had chosen not to put in a reference to the cocaine. And up until that point, I mean, Elementary hadn't really been a thought in anyone's head. I mean, I guess it might have been a thought, but it wasn't out there in the open that this was going on, and not the whole bit with the cocaine habit. And so when you came in and you had this immediate switch from this joyous moment to the drugs bust, and you had that actual, like, oh, we're probably going to go there now, and this is something that they're going to touch on, which is something that I had thought about, of what would you do in a modern day circumstance, because you do have so many. I mean, House is a great example of another Holmesian series where when someone's that intelligent and they don't want to sleep and they need to be going 24/7, you end up with things like cocaine habits and everything. And to have that kind of anti-hero that makes Holmes such a great character, now nodded to. I mean, you have his bad attitude, yes, but here is an actual fault. And on top of it, you have the chaos of the scene, and suddenly you have that slipping moment of showing Holmes not on the top, and it's just for a second, but that was what, it gives you a three-dimensional aspect, as well as I was just like, oh, thank God, because so frequently you want to just put them in the good light, or you do want to just have Holmes as the legendary character and not necessarily show that, you know, two steps away and you could end up with an entirely different scenario altogether.
That kind of brings home what did Greg say about Sherlock being a great man? What was the line?
Yeah, a great man be a good man.
Yeah, I think that right there, I think it's perfectly placed after what you were just saying. He could be a great man, and he ends up being that in his emotions.
I was actually going to say a similar thing, first of all, which is that I, as a person who loves Sherlock Holmes in general, I was glad to see a reference to the drugs, because I think, obviously, there's been tons of scholarship, serious scholarship, about the view of drugs in Doyle's day and how it doesn't in any way really mirror, at least early on when Doyle was writing, the understanding of drugs and drug addiction was not anything like it is now. But I was really glad to see that they weren't going to just completely ignore it. And obviously, I think it's been a slow burn over the series, and I really respect how well they've made that a recurring concept, but they haven't really brought it to a head until we get to very specific points in time where I think it's very logical for the character. But at that point, I was glad to have that introduced. But what I also want to say is there's a big change here between the unaired pilot and the episode, which is that in the unaired pilot, we have Sherlock being drugged and being taken by the cabbie. And in, obviously, the aired episode, we have Sherlock volitionally deciding to go. And I think that's a very, very important change. I think we need to see... No, that's okay. I think we need to see Sherlock, that underlying any addiction he has, whether it's a drug addiction or, you know, other types of things like smoking or whatever, what underlies it is an addiction to risk and to playing the game, if you will. And I think by having that change where he actually makes this decision basically to go and to play this incredibly dangerous game, we see that it's not just about a certain substance. It's about who Sherlock Holmes is as a person and his need to kind of pursue these, like, this amount of risk. So I think for me, that might be one of the most important changes that they made, is how they shifted the end of the episode. I think for me, that's huge, honestly.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And it's sort of, because from that point on, it just becomes much darker. Like, this moment from when, you know, Sherlock asks John to not ask about the drugs, from that point on, Sherlock is sort of, first of all, sort of in his head, right? He's being not okay with, you know, sort of not understanding Jennifer Wilson's feelings for her stillborn daughter, etc. So we have all of that. So we get to know him as this thinking machine who does not quite understand human emotions. And I mean, in that moment, he's right. And this is something which I find quite important, that everyone, right? You see this close-up of Lestrade's face. You see John, who's really upset about it. But they're all, you know, they're all emotional, and therefore they don't get to the answer that Sherlock gets to, which is, you know, that it's just the password for the phone and not any deep emotional connection, which, of course, underlyingly it is. But, you know, in that moment, it's not important. And I think that is quite essential to the person that Sherlock Holmes is in this moment in time, that he is really not necessarily familiar with how people think and how they feel in terms of emotions, but he understands, you know, how they plan ahead and, you know, how Jennifer Wilson felt in that moment. So that is quite important. And then obviously we have this whole cab scene when he gets in, and we know, you know, he can't possibly just give him up to the police, because that's not the person he is, and he needs to have that, you know, that rush. He does it for the rush, which John thankfully understands and follows him, because he understands that, you know, Sherlock has figured out what's going on. And then, as you just said, you know, this whole the pill issue, and that he probably would have swallowed it. And it sort of brings it back, because it is almost the end of the episode, and I think it brings us back really nicely to the beginning of John Watson, who's really sort of lonely, and we have the gun on the table. Obviously, you know, that's Chekhov's gun now, because, you know, it needs to be fired, because it was on the table in the first act. But at the same time, you know, we have an probably suicidal John Watson in the beginning, and then we have a very likely suicidal Sherlock Holmes in the end of this episode. And in the end, we, you know, we need John Watson to use that gun not on himself, not on Sherlock, but on the enemy, and thereby sort of, you know, save both of their lives and start a new life for both of them. And I think that essentially is something that is hugely impressive to do in a single episode of an adaptation, which I really appreciate about this episode specifically.
And just to, you know, for circling back to the beginning, that it's different, you know, it's different types of catalysts that drive each of them to suicidal or potentially suicidal states. And it's also different means of John is isolated, except for the gun and the way that it sort of lingers. Even the first person that we see him speaking with is a therapist. And there's obviously a very rigid distancing air about that whole scene. And even though Sherlock also is facing off against one other person, his sort of, I mean, it's almost like a banter. It's a very dangerous banter, but there is an intimacy about his conversation with the cabbie. And it's sort of, even though, again, Sherlock is supposed to be the more aloof and insular and obviously extremely hard to get along with personality, he can't help but be around people because he's so fascinated by people in that clinical way. And John, who is the sort of tempering his outbursts and the way he treats people, but at least at the beginning is entirely alone. Even the way he initially reacts to Stamford is very curt,
yeah.
Which I think we forget about once we encounter sort of Sherlock's magical self. But they really can outdo each other in that sort of almost cruelty sometimes, like a very clinical approach to human relationships, except between each other.
Yeah. It's true. And I mean, then afterwards, when we have the scene where Sherlock's sort of telling Lestrade off for not having information about the shooter, and we have this notion where he's, you know, again doing his deductions, and then the moment he, you know, he sees John Watson, like, things sort of fall into place and he understands and he knows. Because if, you know, if that whole initial, you know, friendship hadn't already been going on, he probably, you know, he would have cared. He would have just said, okay, obviously, you know, this is the guy. He's a criminal. But he doesn't, right? He's immediately backpedaling and saying, oh, I need to talk about the rent, which is like the most absurd thing you can think about in this moment. But again, Lestrade, you know, he trusts Sherlock and he knows, you know, probably that something's going on. I don't think that Lestrade is not aware that, you know, something strange happened there that day. But, you know, it's a lovely shock blanket scene where I think Lestrade just doesn't care because he knows he had, you know, he had the laugh. So he's going to let Sherlock do whatever he wants to do because he just, you know, he had the satisfaction of people making fun of him. And then we have the lovely, you know, don't giggle at the crime scene kind of thing, which again would have been a perfect ending if it wasn't made more perfect by Mycroft drying up.
Going back to the whole bit where he was making the deductions about John too, I have to say that I always felt it was a nice moment when he's making the deductions, initially getting to a different point with his deductions that it was, you know, if you're Sherlock Holmes, your first response is, well, let me tell you everything I know about the shooter. And he probably shot him either because A, Jefferson Hope was telling too much information, or because perhaps Moriarty wanted to shut him up, or because maybe it was a revenge of somebody else. And when he sees John Watson, a final piece, that final little bit of data comes through that says, oh, wait, someone shot him to save me, which probably up until that point, I don't know if it would have gone through Holmes's head because he's so used to being by himself that why would his first inclination ever to be think that someone would have his back when he's the one who's always having to watch his back because nobody's there for him.
Yeah.
And it's a fun, obviously that's a great canon callback to Holmes talking to Lestrade and being like, oh, ho, ho, you could be talking about Watson by that description. When he obviously is talking about, you know, Watson fleeing the scene. That's Milverton, right? Like the end of
the end of Milverton. I love that scene.
Yeah. And that was something that I really, that's a favorite for me just because of that kind of connection right there. And the fact that I loved as a viewer that we could, the episode is long enough that we could have the introduction of Mycroft and at the very end there, we could have a call forward to Moriarty.
Yeah.
Which we didn't get in the unaired pilot, which was actually really weird because when I went back and watched it and I hadn't watched it in a while, I was like, oh yeah, we didn't, you know, we didn't have this overall series arc connection yet. And I think, you know, it would have been too much for us to have, obviously, Moriarty appear. But I think to go ahead and get that, which obviously Doyle doesn't give us, one of the most you know, vehement criticisms of the canon being that Sherlock Holmes comes up with his mortal nemesis like in 2 seconds, but I love that the series made that more of a slow burn, obviously, so we had kind of something to look forward to with the arc, that we have that balance between the arc and the procedural that I think Sherlock has always done such an amazing job with.
And also what we have is, initially, right, remember Donovan saying, you know, one day Sherlock Holmes is going to be the one who put the body there because he gets bored. Obviously, I mean, John Watson's the one who puts the body there at the end of the episode. But on the other hand side, if you are familiar then with all the other seasons that follow, the two bodies that Sherlock leaves are both because he wants to save John Watson, right? So it's either, I mean, if you want to see Moriarty's suicide and his own, basically, right? So it's actually three bodies he leaves. All of that is because he wants to save his friends. And then even Magnuson is for John and Mary. So there we have this nice character development, which is foreshadowed by Donovan. But again, you know, she's wrong about him, or about sort of his motive of why he kills people. So going from that information that we get, and John getting to know Sherlock from that perspective of Donovan's, sort of really nicely shows the character development that Sherlock goes through from before we know him in A Study in Pink, or from how the people know him before we get to know him in that episode, all the way to the deaths that actually happen in the series. On the other hand side, we meet John Watson, and I remember that we were all quite upset about Magnuson's death in our reaction episode, but on the other hand, nobody was upset about John shooting the cabbie. At least I don't know anyone who is. So I think that is interesting in terms of audience reception, that we think John, you know, did a good job because he wasn't a very nice man, whereas we all hate Magnuson and we still think it's somehow wrong. So I think it's really interesting, not in terms of how the episode or how the series is made, but how we are thinking about the characters.
Yeah, oh, that's such a good point, Maria. Like the spinoff of thoughts on how we view the character roles and almost like we, what's acceptable for Holmes to do versus what's acceptable for Watson to do for the audience is like feelings or sensibilities. That's a very, very interesting point.
I guess if you think about it, because they always have the, like, Sherlock would try to find a, what's it called? He would, like, try to rationalize why this person has to die. Like, there's a meaning, like, Magson has to die, otherwise they're not going to be able to be free. John, though, has always represented emotion, the heart, if you will. And for that heart, someone presumably who cares so much to make the decision to end a life, it's almost like, yeah, he really, there's a deeper reason behind it or something. And then again, to be fair, that cabbie really wasn't a very nice person. I mean, look at the route he took to get them there. No, overall, though, that episode, the impression it gave me as a whole, like the very first time I watched it, because again, I put off watching the BBC Sherlock for a while. Series 2 had just concluded. So that I just said, I'll watch the first episode and we'll see what happens. And it was a lot for one episode. I'm introduced to these, you know, we're introduced to Sherlock, we're introduced to John, I'm meeting Mycroft, we're getting hints of Moriarty. And I am familiar with canon and everything. So when I was like watching, I was like, oh, hey, I'm catching all these different little things or whatnot. And it was just a great start. It was like welcome to the world of Sherlock. You want to stay for the ride. And I was like, yeah, next episode. Come on, let's go. You know, and the addiction was born there. So I think that it was a fantastic, I mean, the episode's long, but it had so much in it and it drew you into their world. It gave you a taste of everything. And like saying that like, you're going to find out more about Sherlock and you're going to find out more about his and John's relationship. You're going to find out more about Moriarty. Will Mycroft continue to show up? And all these other, I think it's just great. It was a great way to introduce everybody to their, like, you know, welcome to our world. And I think it was very well done.
And it left you wanting to talk about it afterwards, because I think I got into it on a kind of opposite end rather early, even in the U.S. And I had so many people that when it first aired within that first month already talking about it. It was already on everything that I was following, and anybody that I was talking to had already talked about this amazing series that kind of reminded them of Jackal if Jackal had been done, in their opinion, better, which I had been familiar with before as well, but hadn't caught my interest in the way that the first 10 minutes had of Sherlock. But I think one of the things that they did so much better and that the characters also lend themselves to more is that I finished the episode and immediately wanted more people to converse with, because it left you with so many loose ends, but it also left you with so many new storylines that, you know, instead of sitting back and going, okay, now I want to think on it, it wasn't just thinking, it was also a matter of who can I discuss this idea, or where they're going to go with this, or what's going to happen with Mycroft, and what kind of storylines you can branch off. I mean, in the same way that Holmes, Sherlock Holmes itself, the canon, automatically made itself a fertile ground for pastiches or songs or any kind of caricatures right off the bat, I felt that Sherlock BC was one of a great adaptation that gave you a contemporary feel that made you want to do the same. It was just this fertile ground to be able to pull from and create a sense of community rather than just a really great piece of cinematography and great show, of which it was, but open it up to a whole new like possibility just with that first episode, and leaving you with enough hanging that you had to, you know, it was an automatic, okay, great, where's the next one?
Yeah. And I think what it did in terms of getting people interested in Sherlock Holmes again is, like, we can't stress that enough. I know the Sherlock fans have been made fun of from all sides of the spectrum, but it is so important that it cemented this interest in maybe not necessarily canon stories themselves, but in the material, in the characters, in being smart, in applying yourself, right? I mean, I remember going out of this episode thinking, okay, I gotta pay more attention to stuff, to the world. You know, there's so much out there, because, I mean, you get that in the stories, but because of the pace and everything we talked about now, you felt like, you know, you just saw that it's possible. You were part of this. You were part of this ride, and, you know, you felt that you could somehow do this. And I remember that out of everyone I talked to, maybe one or two people, didn't like the series for very valid reasons, but the large majority was completely in love with this. And so I think in terms of how, I mean, the Ritchie films, yes, they were, I mean, they were fun, they were awesome, they were loud, they were explosive. But I can't remember...
Slow-mo people, camera.
Yeah, I can't remember, like, people being that excited about them. Like, it was a thing, and it was funny, and, you know, Jude Law was hot and all of that. But it wasn't, it didn't trigger that kind of need to talk about things, and this need to get onto the next episode. As Sherlock did. So I think in terms of like looking back at the last years and the different material, the different adaptations that were made of Sherlock Holmes, I think Sherlock was the one decisive one that really sort of pushed, you know, sort of people to want more of it and to talk about it, as you said, Tiffany, and to like want to be part of it, reproduce it, write fan fiction about it, art, you know, do all that.
No, cosplay. The art.
Well, it did cause a resurgence, most definitely. And I think it's because it's set in the modern times. I mean, it's a fun idea to think of, like, what would the world be like? Or what would Sherlock's world be like with Facebook? And, God, I would love to see with Snapchat or something. You know, he's in the modern world, and he's in our world, in a way. It's a world that we can relate to. It's one thing to read the stories and read about the times that he was in, but it's a whole other one to be reading about, or not reading, in this case, watching him interacting in our world, in our universe. And I think that's what made it so, that's like, that kind of what drove me to watch in the first place. It was like, oh, so this is a modern, there have been so many like other Sherlock Holmes series, and it's all set in the Victorian era, and they're all good, and you know, for the various ways, but for them to bring it into the modern world, that's what got me in there. I'm like, oh, well, this should be interesting. You know, how are they gonna do this? Like, what differences are they gonna have or whatnot? And I just went in there with like eyes wide open, like, okay, let's see what happens. And certainly I think what makes this series so addicting is that while I had my reservations about Benedict, as I continue to watch, I'm like, wow, he's a really good Sherlock. And then of course John is an amazing Watson with his little micro expressions. And then the cast of characters that they put in here that are very different. And that's how come I think when like the special came out, and Mrs. Hudson, who, you know, she didn't have much to say in the books, but now we have this, you know, lovely, sweet old lady who apparently had a interesting past and everything. Like, you get more development, you get more out of it. I think that's why people have so much, like, more interest in it. And it certainly appeals to these younger audiences. And it does get some of them to go ahead and look at the canon. And it does the main job of it, keeps Sherlock Holmes alive. I mean, we're still talking about him, and he was created a very long time ago. I think that's absolutely brilliant, and I'm so happy that the show came about in the first place, that people are talking about it. For God's sakes, we, you know, podcast is here, and we're still talking about this. It's really good, I think.
And at the same time, we do get to feel like the Victorians felt, you know, doing it sort of in real time, feeling that Sherlock Holmes might have, you know, just went to the, I don't know, you know, to the concert that I also went to yesterday at the Royal Opera House. So in the end, I guess it's, you know, it is this modern time adaptation, but it is just as modern. I think Moffat said that in one of the very early interviews, right, saying that that's what they wanted. They wanted to do away with all the sort of the cobwebs and the dust, and wanted to recreate Sherlock how the Victorian and Edwardian readers would have read the stories, because for them they were contemporary. For them, Sherlock Holmes was present right then. So I think it's just, you know, it was a brilliant idea to do this, and it worked perfectly to transplant it into now. I think that is the reason, exactly as you just said, for the ongoing interest or the rediscovered interest into Sherlock Holmes. Yeah,
exactly. And changing up the characters enough as well to make them fresh and new. Because while I also thought, I immediately watched it and thought that they did an amazing job capturing the characters right off the pages of the book, there are enough differences that, you know, I didn't feel the need to necessarily go back to the books or go back to a different adaptation and be writing the same thing, which, you know, is where Granada does such a great job with those taking the characters off the pages and putting them down. And while there are nuances that are different, a lot of them are the same. But in the case of Sherlock, it was, you had this automatically definitely recognizable character, but the characters are new and they are different, and there are things that not necessarily are the canonical characters. So now you have something fun and new to play with, which, you know, has gotten truer and truer as time passes for some people's dislike in it or some people's liking of it. But regardless, across the board, always leaves you guessing, unlike another adaptation, in which case you already kind of know what Holmes is going to do because you've seen him do it 60 or 100 other times. In this case, mm-hmm. you're kind of left on the edge because you don't quite know what the Sherlock BBC Sherlock is going to do. He's not quite Holmes, you know, and that is where, you know, you end up wanting to write. You may have written 1,000 fanfics about canon Holmes or about, you know, Granada, but now you have somebody new and different that's in a similar field and that you know the history of and you can bounce off of, but have a different character entirely to go with.
Precisely. Well said.
All right. So I would suggest that we just finish talking about this episode now. There will be 2 more sometime in the near future. But thanks so much for joining us. And you'll hear more about The Blind Banker soon. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Bye.
Bye.
This quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two to one?